Chapter 35. What Thursday Did Next. Kenyan government to fund anti-Smite shield. Article in The Mole, July 1988. Mr. Yorick Kane yesterday announced plans to set up a defensive network to counter the growing threat of God's wrath unto his creations. Specific details of the anti-Smite shield are still classed top secret, but defense experts and top theologians have both agreed that a system might be in place within 5 years. Kane's followers point to the smiting of the small town of Oswestry with a rain of cleansing fire last October, and the Rutland plague of toads. "Both Oswestry and Rutland are wake-up calls to our nation," said Mr. Kane. "They may have been sinful, but ultimate retribution, without due process of law, is something that I will not tolerate. In today's modern world, where the accepted definition of sin has become blurred, we need to protect ourselves against an overzealous deity keen to promote an outdated set of rules. It is for this reason that we are investing in anti-Smite technology. The £14 billion contract will be awarded exclusively to Goliath Weapons Incorporated." The news networks had a field day. The death of St. Zivilcix so soon after his resurrection raised a few eyebrows, but the window maker's somewhat bizarre accident while on assignment became a sensation, supplanting even the upcoming superhoop from the front pages. Incredibly, despite severe internal injuries and a devastating head wound, she didn't die. She was taken to St. Septic's Hospital, where they battled to stabilize her. Not from any great sense of moral duty, you understand, but for the fact that she could finger the 67 or 68 clients who had paid her to carry out her foul trade. And this was a prize the prosecutors were keen to claim. Within an hour of her coming out of surgery, 3 attempts by underworld bosses had been made to silence her for good. She was moved to the secure ward at the Kingsdown Home for the Criminally Insane, and there she stayed, comatose, attached to a ventilator. "Spike was right. I should have told him earlier," I said to Gran. "Or tipped off the authorities, or something." Granny Next was feeling a lot better today. Although greatly enfeebled by her advanced years, she had actually walked around for a bit that morning. When I arrived, she had her reading glasses on and was surrounded by stacks of well-read tomes. The kind of things one generally reads for study and rarely for pleasure. "But you didn't," she replied, looking over the top of her spectacles. "And your father knew you wouldn't when he told you." "He also said that I would decide whether she lived or died. But he was wrong. It's out of my hands now." I rubbed my scalp and sighed. "Poor Spike. He's taking it very badly." "Where is he?" "Still being interviewed by SO9. They got an agent down from London who's been after her for more than 10 years. I'd be there yet but for Flanker."
"Flanker?" queried Gran. "What did he do?"
"He came to thank me for leading SO14 to a huge stockpile of hidden Danish literature."
"I thought you were trying not to help them."
I shrugged. "So did I. How was I to know the Danish underground really was using the Australian Writers' Guild as a depository?"
"Did you tell them it was Kane who had paid her to kill you?"
"No," I said, looking down. "I don't know who I can trust, and the last thing I need is to be taken into protective custody or something. If I'm not at the touchline tomorrow for the superhoop, the Neanderthals won't play."
"But there is good news, surely."
"Yes," I said, brightening somewhat. "We got some Danish books out of the country. Hamlet is on the mend. And I got Landon back." Gran stared at me and lifted my face with her hand.
"For good?"
I looked down at my wedding ring. 24 hours and counting.
"They did the same to me," sighed Gran,
taking off her glasses and rubbing her eyes with a bony hand.
"We were very happy for over 40 years, until he was taken away again. This time, in a more natural and inevitable way. And that was over 30 years ago."
She fell silent for a moment, and to distract her, I told her about St. Zivilkix and his death and his revealments, and how little of it made any sense. Time-travelling paradoxes tended to make my head spin.
"Sometimes," said Gran, holding up the cover of the Swindon Evening Globe, "the facts are all in front of us. We just have to get them in the right order."
I took the picture and stared at it. It had been taken a few seconds after the piano fell on Cindy. I hadn't realized how far the wreckage of the Steinway had scattered. A little way down the road, the lonely figure of Zivilkix was still lying on the pavement, abandoned in the drama. "Can I keep this?"
"Of course. Be careful, my dear. Remember that your father can't warn you of every single one of your potential demises. Invulnerability is reserved only for superheroes. The croquet final is far from won, and anything can happen in the next 24 hours."
"A Neanderthal defence?" repeated Aubrey and Alf when I found them taking pegging out at the croquet stadium. They had threatened to fire me if I didn't tell them what I was up to. "Of course, any team would spend millions trying to get a Neanderthal to join, but they just won't do it." "I've already got them. You can't pay them, and I really don't know how they will work as a team with humans. I get the feeling that there'll be a team of their own within your team." "I don't care," said Aubrey, leaning on his mallet and sweeping a hand in the direction of the squad. "I was fooling myself. Biffo's too old, Smudger has a drink problem, and Snake is mentally unstable. George is okay, and I can handle myself, but a fresh crop of talent has infused the Whackers team. They'll be fielding people like Bone Crusher McSneed." He wasn't kidding. A mysterious benefactor, probably Goliath, had given a vast amount of money to the Whackers, enough for them to buy almost anyone they wanted. Goliath was taking no chances that the seventh revealment would be fulfilled. "So, we're still in the game with 5 Thals. "Yes," said Aubrey with a smile. "We're still in the game." I dropped in to see Mum on the way home, ostensibly to take Hamlet and the Dodos round to Landon's place. I found my mother in the kitchen with Bismarck, who seemed to be in the middle of telling her a joke.
"And then the white horse, he says, 'What, Eric?'"
"Oh, Herr B," said my mother, giggling and slapping him on the shoulder. "You are a wag." She noticed me standing there.
"Thursday, are you okay? I heard on the radio there was some sort of accident involving a piano."
"I'm fine, Mum, really." I stared coldly at the Prussian Chancellor, who, I had decided, was taking liberties with my mother's affections. "Good afternoon, Herr Bismarck. So, you haven't sorted out the Schleswig-Holstein question yet?"
"I am waiting for the Danish Prime Minister," replied Bismarck, rising to greet me. "But I am growing impatient."
"I expect him very soon, Herr Bismarck," said my mother, putting the kettle on the stove. "Would you like a cup of tea while you're waiting?"
He bowed politely again. "Only if Badenburg cake we will be having."
"I'm sure there's a bit left over, if that naughty Mr. Hamlet hasn't eaten it."
Her face dropped when she discovered that, indeed, naughty Mr. Hamlet had eaten it.
"Oh, dear. Would you like an almond slice instead?"
Bismarck's eyebrows twitched angrily.
"Everywhere I turn, the Danish are mocking my person and the German Confederation," he intoned angrily, smacking his fist into his open palm. "The incorporation of the Duchy of Schleswig into Danish state overlooked I might have, but personal Battenberg insult I will not. It is war."
"Hang on a minute, Otto," said my mother, who, having brought up a large family almost single-handedly, was well placed to sort out the whole Battenberg-Schleswig-Holstein issue. "I thought we'd agreed that you weren't going to invade Denmark."
"That was then. This is now," muttered the Chancellor,
puffing out his chest so aggressively that one of his brass buttons shot across the room and struck Pickwick a glancing blow on the back of the head.
"Choice. Mr. Hamlet, for his behaviour, apologises on behalf of Danish people, or we go to war."
"He's talking to that nice conflict resolution man at the moment," replied my mother in an anxious tone.
"Then it is war," announced Bismarck, sitting down at the table and having an almond slice anyway. "More talk is pointless. Return, I wish, to 1863."
And then the door opened. It was Hamlet. He stared at us all and looked, well, different.
"Ah," he said, drawing his sword, "Bismarck, your aggressive stance against Denmark is at an end. Prepare to die."
The conflict resolution talk had obviously affected him deeply. Bismarck, unmoved by the sudden threat to his life, drew a pistol.
"So, Badenberg, you finish behind my back, yes?"
And they might have killed one another there and then if Mum and I hadn't intervened. "Hamlet," I said, "killing Bismarck won't get your father back, now will it?"
"Otto," said Mum, "killing Hamlet won't alter the feelings of the Schleswigers, now will it?"
I took Hamlet into the hall and tried to explain why sudden retributive action might not be such a good idea after all.
"I disagree," he said, swishing his sword through the air. "The first thing I shall do when I get home is kill that murdering uncle of mine, marry Ophelia, and take on Fortinbras. Better still, I shall invade Norway in a preemptive bid, and then Sweden, and... what's the one next to that? Finland? That's the one."
He placed his left hand on his hip and lunged aggressively with his sword at some imaginary foe. Pickwick made the mistake of walking into the corridor at that precise moment and made a startled plouk noise as the point of Hamlet's rapier stopped 2 inches from her head. She looked unsteady for a moment, then fainted clean away.
"That conflict management specialist really taught me a thing or two, Miss Next. Apparently, my problem was an unresolved or latent conflict, the death of my father, that persists and festers in an individual, me. To face up to problems, we must meet those conflicts head-on and resolve them to the best of our ability."
It was worse than I thought. "So you won't pretend to be mad and talk a lot, then?"
"No need," replied Hamlet, laughing. "The time for talking is over. Polonius will be for the high jump, too. As soon as I marry his daughter, he'll be fired as adviser and made chief librarian or something. Yes, we're going to have some changes around my play, I can tell you."
"What about building tolerance between opponents for a long-standing peaceful and ultimately rewarding coexistence between the conflicting parties?"
"I think he was going to cover that in the second session. It doesn't matter. By this time tomorrow, Hamlet will be a dynamic tale of one man's revenge and rise to power as the single greatest king Denmark has ever seen. It's the end of Hamlet the Ditherer, and the beginning of Hamlet the Man of Action. There's something rotten in the state of Denmark, and Hamlet says, it's payback time."
This was bad. I couldn't send him back until Mrs. Tiggywinkle and Shakespeare had sorted out his play. And in this condition, there was no saying what he was capable of. I had to think fast. "Good idea, Hamlet. But before that, I think you might like to know that Danish people are being insulted and maligned here in England, and that Kierkegaard, Andersen, Branner, Blixen, and Farquhar are having their books burned." He went quiet and stared at me with dumbstruck horror in his eyes. "I am doing what I can to stop this," I went on. "But..."
"Daphne's books are being burned?"
"You know of her?"
"Of course. I'm a big fan. We have to have something to do during those long winters at Elsinore. Mum's a big fan, too, although my uncle prefers Catherine Cookson. But enough talk," he carried on, his post-prevarication, non-hesitative brain clicking over rapidly.
What shall we do about it?
Everything hinges on us winning the Super Hoop tomorrow. But we need a show of force in case Kane tries anything. Can you get together as many Danish supporters as you can?
Is it very important?
It could be vital. Hamlet's eyes flashed with steely resolution. He picked his skull off the hall table, placed a hand on my shoulder, and struck a dramatic pose.
By tomorrow morning, my friend, you will have more Danes than you know what to do with. But stay this idle chitter-chatter. I must away.
And without another word, he was out the door. From all talk, no action, he was now all action, no talk. I should never have brought him into the real world.
By the way, said Hamlet, who had popped his head back round the door, you won't tell Ophelia about Emma, will you?
My lips are sealed. I gathered up the dodos and popped them in the car, then drove home. I had called Landon soon after Cindy's accident to say I was unhurt. He said he knew all along I'd come to no harm, and I promised that I'd avoid assassins where possible from now onwards. I couldn't pull up outside the house, as there were at least three news vans, so I parked around the back, walked through the alleyway, nodded a greeting to Millen, and walked across the back lawn to the French windows.
Lipsum,
said Friday, running up to give me a hug. I picked him up as Alan sized up his new home, trying to work out the areas of highest potential mischief.
There's a telegram for you on the table, said Landon. And if you're feeling masochistic, the press would love you to reiterate how the Mallets will win tomorrow.
Well, I'm not, I replied, tearing open the telegram. How was your... My voice trailed off as I read the telegram. It was clear and to the point. We have unfinished business. Come alone, no tricks. Hangar D, Swindon Air Park. Kane.
Darling, I called out.
Yes,
came Landon's voice from upstairs.
I have to go out.
Assassins?
No. Megalomaniac tyrants keen on global domination.
Do you want me to wait up?
No, but Friday needs a bath. And don't forget behind the ears.